My name is Jen Tierney, and you're listening to How to Make a Memory, a show that explores the items we make for one another and how they impact our relationships. For this first episode, I'm sitting down with my dear friend Aaliyah. I met Aaliyah in 2013 when we were both working at a startup together in Boston. She's a brilliant woman who has a fascinating perspective to share. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. So hi, Aaliyah. Thank you for being my very first guest.
Thank you. I don't really know what to expect from this.
Neither do I. Neither do any of us.
All right. Figure it out as we go along.
That's right.
Just let the alcohol course through your veins.
I know. We've
had, let it loosen your tongue.
Had a little bit of delightful summer sangria.
Yes. Provided by our sound engineer today.
Yes. Our lovely sound engineer, Becky Carpenter, is manning the laptop for us. I shouldn't say manning. She's womaning the laptop for us.
There you go.
And made us some delightful sangria to get us a little bit comfortable, since this is, you know, the maiden voyage of this podcast experiment of mine.
So, okay, what's the name of this podcast? Let's start there.
Okay, great. So the podcast is going to be called How to Make a Memory.
All right.
It's not going to be called. It is called. This is real. This is happening. So, so it's called How to Make a Memory. Okay. And what I'm trying to do is speak with people and collect stories about the things that we make for one another and how that brings us closer to the people that we care about, the people who care about us. And so when I was talking to you about this initially, I really thought that your initial reaction of, oh, I'd love to talk about, you know, learning how to make Southern food. So I was like, oh, would you come and be on my podcast?
Because
that sounds excellent. So maybe you can tell everybody a little bit about yourself and your background and your family and Southern food.
Yeah. So in terms of my background, I come from sort of a multiracial, multicultural background. My mom is from New England. My dad is from South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And growing up, it was one of those weird things that I felt kind of disconnected from a lot of my extended family. I spent more time with my mom's side of the family because I think both of my parents really miss New England. I grew up in North mm-hmm. Carolina. They had lived there previously. My sister grew up there for the first half of her life, and then we moved just because, you know, the job opportunities and everything else were better. You know, they really miss New England. I think that's where they really came of age. That's where they met. So we spent more time there. And since my mom's family is up in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. we just spent more time with her. And then on the flip side, my family, I was raised Muslim, so a lot of Southern food was kind of inaccessible to a certain degree, just because there were things that I just couldn't eat. So it was just one of those things that, like, I had more experience. Also, that side of the family in the South is Southern Baptist, so it was just, like, worlds apart in terms of, like, religion and everything else. But, yeah, I got to a point when I was about 21. I still remember being, it was the summer before my senior year of college. I was traveling around Germany and Austria by myself, and I just mm-hmm. decided, you know, like, I appreciate Islam for everything it's given me in terms of a cultural background, but mm-hmm. it wasn't something that I really practiced personally. And I was just like, you know what? Floodgates are open. I love traveling. I'm tired of having certain options in terms of food and experiencing other cultures, you know, cut off for me. And I was just like, you know what? I'm going to eat pork for the first time ever. I literally went to a little stand in Berlin.
You're the perfect place to eat pork.
I know. Seriously. I got currywurst, which is delicious.
Geez, yeah.
And that was it. And it was just sort of like, luckily I didn't get too sick. So that was great. I still would say I'm not used to it. Like, I feel like it's one of those tastes that I'm just like, oh, I don't know. I don't know about this. It's still kind of unfamiliar, but and, you know, part of that learning how to cook with Southern food has been, you know, getting used to that. But, that's sort of my background. And then on top of that, so you and I know each other from working for a tech company. Mm-hmm. But as you know, I left my job a couple of years ago and decided to become a baker. So mm-hmm. not only do I love cooking and eating, but I also do it professionally. So it's just been this kind of matrix of learning how to cook and getting used to these kind of new cultural elements that I had mm-hmm. never really been exposed to as much mm-hmm. Before. So for me, the only time I really got to see my dad's side of the family was during funerals.
Oh.
And it was just sort of like some older relative died that I had no idea who they were. But a big portion of that, I guess funerals were very... I've never really been to a funeral on my mother's side, so I don't really know how to compare and contrast it. On my dad's side of the family, it's very much a kind of a huge gathering. It's just everyone gathers in the church. It's, you know, you think of very stereotypical kind of gospel celebrations. Mm-hmm. Everyone's hollering and people participate in the service in the way that I wasn't used to. So that was very foreign. And then going into this, I don't even know the name of the town that my dad grew up in. It's so small. It's like on the border of North and South Carolina, near the coast, like tiny, tiny, sleepy town. Mm-hmm. Like, I swear, like, you know, it's trailers and dirt roads and lots of farms and probably more pigs than people.
Yeah.
But it was just such an experience of everyone gathering together, of, you know, expressing grief and sympathy and really coming together to celebrate a family member. And a big part of that celebration was food.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, and everyone would bring food to the table. It was just a giant potluck. And the way my dad grew up is he grew up relatively poor. And in those days, it was, you know, he was born in maybe the mid to late 50s. So in that time, it was very customary to grow a lot of your own food, to hunt, to fish, to do a lot of those things. And I think Southern food has this reputation of being really fatty and really, I guess, very decadent.
Yeah, very rich.
Yeah, or just kind of maybe low class in some ways, where people think of lots of canned food and lots of mayonnaise and butter and kind of that stereotypical thing. And, you know, that wasn't... There have been a lot of changes in the way people eat because of industrialization. People didn't really eat canned food. You had to grow your own food. You had to hunt. You had to fish. And, of course, being Black as well, Black and primarily Indian on my side, that side of the family, is sort of they didn't really get access to a lot of that industrialized food because they were so poor. So it was just a very different experience of Southern food for me, where it was my dad's, brother, like frying up catfish that he had caught earlier that morning, and, you know, things like that. And of course, soul food is definitely a part of that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that side of the family is primarily Black. Like, there's a lot of soul food involved.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like some of my favorite meals are just like grits or traditional cornbread, which has no sugar. And I have such an issue. Every time I get cornbread up north, it's so sweet.
It does, yes.
And so flowery. And I'm just like, this is not how it's made.
No.
Or just like simple greens that, you know, are basically weeds that you foraged. I haven't seen my dad's side of the family in a very long time. Probably the last time I really saw them was when my great-grandmother died. Miss Plummy is what I called her. And I was terrified of her. She was, like, I loved her to death, but she was a very traditional Southern matriarch. The kind of person that it was always no ma'am or yes ma'am. She was just very kind, but she was very no-nonsense. You know, she had grown up during the Depression. She had seen several of her own children die before her just because of poverty and, you know, all these other things. And she just, you know, she was the glue, in a sense, that held the family together. Certainly the glue that kept me coming back there and my family coming back there. So the last time I really saw a lot of that side of the family was when she died at the ripe age of 97.
Oh, my goodness.
That was really the thing that I think years later is wondering about her and her life that really made me think maybe I should learn how to cook these dishes. And specifically because my dad at some point kind of looked at me one day and was like, you know, you really remind me of her, which is both a compliment and also maybe a little bit of shade from him.
Because
I can be just as bossy and like temperamental as she could be. And I think it was kind of a double, you know, a backhanded compliment in that in that respect. But that's kind of really what started me.
What was maybe the first thing you learned how to make as you were experimenting with making Southern food yourself?
I definitely think traditional cornbread. It comes back to a lot of that. and kind of going along with the idea of eating pork for the first time mm-hmm. and all of those sorts of things. You know, the way that my dad ate cornbread as a kid is it was always made in a cast iron pan mm-hmm. and he continued that tradition, even if he, you know, varied the ingredients. Still remember him making cornbread with soy milk and like blue corn, which he never would have done, yeah. you know, back in the day. But it was just, you know, he was experimenting. Mm-hmm. He also loves to cook. So, but I made it the traditional way, yellow milled coarse corn. Mm-hmm. Use the bacon drippings as your fat. There's mm-hmm. no flour in it, no sugar. You get the pan hot first, mm-hmm. and it's a very thick, clumpy batter, and you just mm-hmm. kind of put it in there. And it's, and it is a very kind of rough, like mm-hmm. peasant food, really. Yeah. It's a slightly, just a little bit dry, like you have that savory flavor. Nothing like what you'd get as cornbread, like yeah. up here.
I made cornbread this weekend for a barbecue, and it definitely had sugar and flour, but it was like just a little bit of sugar, so it's kind of like Southern. And, and as you're describing it now, I'm like, this is nothing like Southern. Yeah. What I made was tasty, but and not.
Granted, I do have to say that. Of course, it's like any cuisine where mm-hmm. people are like, no, my way mm-hmm. or my family's way of doing it is the right way.
Yeah.
And people will have those arguments. So it, like, I mean, it's fine.
You're talking to an Italian, so I yeah, totally you get understand. It. You get it. It's like, listen, sauce is sauce. Gravy is gravy. There's the right way to do it and the wrong way to do it. It's, yeah, it's really incredible. So my husband Joe and I went to Europe. I forget where we were exactly, but I remember going to snack bars. Mm-hmm. Did you go to any, like, I think that's what they called them there, which I thought was really, like, really, that's what you call them? You'd walk in and it was this little hole-in-the-wall place and they were everywhere. And they just sort of had a deli counter and inside of them were just breaded meats. Yeah. And they would just fry them and hand them to you. Oh, and you'd eat them at, like, 2 in the morning and then go sit in a hookah bar for an hour. It was just, like, the way that they do meat in the Germany area of the world is so different.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds so tasty.
I think that we, especially in New England, now this is one of the more health conscious areas of the country. Yes. And so we're very, you know, like, well, only have a piece of meat the size of your palm and it needs to have all the fat taken off of it. And, you know, and I think that there are a lot of cultures that embrace and use all that good fat and juice. Yeah. And, so good.
And just every part of the animal, yep. too. Mm-hmm. Just every single part.
Yes. I think when you get into traditional cultures, you see, you know, like the more traditional food you find in almost any culture, you run into these examples of, you know, maybe they cook with an animal or an item that is uncommon elsewhere, but right. they use everything from
you
it.
Have you have to, you know?
It's just,
if all you have is the one pig to yep. last you through the winter, you gotta make that's everything.
Right. Oh my goodness. So it's interesting. I just happened to be listening to an episode of a podcast the other day called Reveal, where they talked about a black man from North Carolina who mm-hmm. is a pig farmer and how difficult it's been for him since 1991 when he tried mm-hmm. to open the farm up until now when last year his farm was foreclosed on
yeah.
because of all of the systemic racism that goes on in the loan industry, the government loan
yeah,
industry.
Yeah.
I think that it's heartbreaking to listen to his story. It's incredible to me that your father grew up in that environment but extricated himself from yeah. it because it seems like so many people get trapped in it.
Yeah, and I know for one thing, my dad is quite light-skinned. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that a lot of people would necessarily think he's black when they first meet yeah. him. He gets Arab or Latino
yeah. Yeah.
quite a lot, occasionally Asian, which I guess I can kind of see, but I think that was part of it. Also, his family came into a little bit of money and they mm-hmm. shipped him off. He went away to military school and mm. then he ended up at Andover,
yeah.
you know, Phillips Andover.
What a nice place to end up.
Yeah, like, you know, ended up at Harvard yeah. Med School, wow. like did his residency at
That's
MGH.
Right, he's a doctor.
Yeah, so, you know, he came up from that background yeah. for sure. And, you know, other members of my family have done pretty well for themselves mm-hmm. as well. I think, you know, they were just lucky in that regard. And I think there is a tradition in the South of having a very, I guess, respectable, and I'm using air quotes for that, not necessarily because it's not true, but just because it's a very particular mentality among certain classes of Black people of, you know, I don't want to be that kind of Black person. You know what I mean? Where there's very, among certain generations, there's a very big kind of cultural and class-based divide, where it's just sort of like, I'm not associated with, you know, maybe more seemingly negative, and again, negative is in air quotes, aspects of Black culture. And I think both of my parents are steeped in a lot of that. Certainly my mother is. She's probably like rolling her eyes if she ever hears this. Please don't let my parents know that I've told them. I've said this about them. But I, you know, my mother grew up in Boston. A lot of her friends and a lot of the people that she knew were Boston Brahmin. Like, she just grew up in a very, I think Bostonians in general, we're very class conscious. Like, I think that's very ingrained into New England. You know, the New England part, I think, is very true, where we got some of those cultural elements of just like, oh, you know, I'm upper class. And of course, you know, like the Andover connection and all of this other thing is, it just like makes it 10 times worse. And it's just like there is that kind of, I guess, respectability politics that are involved. And I think for me, and talking to my sister, I think both of us have, and again, partially it's because of my religious background and sort of my mother's own cultural affinity is more towards the South Asian kind of Middle Eastern elements of our family. So I've grown up around a lot of that, where it's just been ingrained in me of like going over to my Pakistani's friend's house for iftar during Ramadan and just, you know, going to the Lebanese market and getting Jordan almonds after Sunday school and so like having to memorize portions of the Quran. Like, that's so ingrained in me. And so I think so culturally, it's just such a part of my cultural identity in a way that being Black is not, that it was, I still feel this kind of tension of like, how do I explore this in a way that feels authentic and still keeps in mind that, you know, I do have this other cultural element. Like, I was raised Muslim. Like, I can't get away from that. Like, that is a huge portion of my childhood and my identity. But at the same time, there's this entire other world that I really haven't been exposed to. And in many respects, has been talked down on because of the kind of negative associations of like, no, like, oh, I'm not Black. I'm really Arab. But it's like, I can be both. And I know, like, I know a lot of kids that either are adopted by people who are not the same race or who are multiracial, biracial, have these similar elements of like, how do I combine these, all these elements of myself? But it's just, I feel like if you are Black, there is an added element of anti-Blackness and colorism and all of these kind of issues just within the Black community, not even talking about like all the kind of other racism you might experience outside it. That's just like, I don't know how to reconcile that. And I think food was a way of safely exploring that because I love food. I love to eat. But it felt authentic in a way that, I don't know, doing more stereotypical things, I guess, didn't really kind of gel.
Yeah, I think that, so when I was initially thinking about doing a podcast, I had thought very seriously about having it be completely focused on food only. Because I think that what you've touched on is that food is sort of like this thing that everyone can participate in, that everyone does.
Everyone has an opinion about, you know?
Everybody, and every culture has a food, has a cuisine, has a way that they approach food. And so if you come from two different worlds, you can explore those two different foods and still be authentic. And you can combine those foods. I think that that's where some of the best cooking comes from, is from people who are biracial or multi-ethnic, and they say, I love these two sides of my history, and I want to combine them.
Yeah.
And some of the most amazing, you know, food experiments have come out of that.
Yeah. So. And food is so visceral, both literally mm-hmm. and figuratively. I mm-hmm. feel like it can just transport you. Smell and taste can just transport you to a place, a time.
Absolutely.
You know, it can remind you of a particular person. And it's just so, I don't know, the feeling is so intense sometimes mm-hmm. of kind of how it relates to all of these issues and ideas, and even kind of touching on, like, forget the cultural aspects, but just like the aspects of your own body.
Of course.
You know, it becomes
yeah.
very, very intense when you start going in that direction.
Yeah. Food is like the way that we use it.
Right.
In like the mechanical sense, it really, there's this emotional aspect to
right.
it.
Right.
But as it travels through you, it makes you physically feel things that
yeah.
sometimes are very pleasant and sometimes are very unpleasant. You know, it's sort of like...
you know, the funny, well, maybe the ironic thing is if my dad had eaten and had continued to eat in a more traditional manner, he might actually be better off.
Mm.
Like, looking at his diet or in the kinds of things he said he ate as a kid, he really didn't eat a lot of meat because, you know, if you have chickens and other animals, you have to, you know, you want their eggs. You want to keep them around for as long as possible.
Mm.
Like, maybe you'd kill one hog, but you don't want to kill all of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, he ate a lot of greens. Mm-hmm. Again, he grew up near the coast, so a lot of seafood and a lot of beans.
Yeah.
Which, it's kind of a typical peasant-y, kind of poor people diet and very rural diet. And I sometimes wonder if maybe the shift over the years of starting out eating one way and then eating vastly differently when he was older and wealthier and, you know, had less time on his hands made a big impact on his health.
Hmm.
And maybe it would have actually benefited him to, you know, get more in touch with that side of his
yeah.
background.
Hmm.
So, you know.
So let's say you were to go down and visit your family. Is there anything that you feel like next time you go down you want to make for people and share with them?
Well,
and...
I feel like all of my aunties probably have that covered. I think it would be more of a matter of learning.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, one of the big things for me, and especially now working in the food industry and kind of seeing how all of these various parts work together and seeing how much food is wasted, I think I have a huge interest in the way that food is produced. And I think part of that, again, is the influence of my dad. He's always been a huge gardener. I think that feeling of kind of growing your own food never really left him, because we've always had like a little vegetable garden
sure.
or herbs or something like that, just kind of something tangible, I think, to hold on to in terms of cooking and eating and all these other things. Is I'm fascinated by the way that food is produced. I really do want to try hunting and fishing. I've done a little bit. I have part of your culinary school education is that you do have to butcher meat and
sure.
You have to gut fish, scale it, do all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, you're usually coming from a smaller hunk of the animal. At least
yeah.
I did in my class. I didn't have the whole hog or whatever.
Yeah.
But I would love to do that. And
yeah.
I think it's just, it's a very different experience of, say, eating wild fowl versus something farmed. Again, learning from my aunties and my uncles and collecting as much information because... You know, I'm at the point my parents are in their 60s and they have health issues. And it's one of those things where it's like, I was too young to really understand the significance of someone like my great-grandmother passing or even of living that long, to
sure.
be honest, of just that she was history. You know, she was living history in terms of actual American history. You know, my entire family has been influenced by slavery, by the Trail of Tears, by Loving v. Virginia, and things of these natures. She was such an embodiment of American history, but she was also an embodiment of family history, and a lot of that is gone with her. And there, I realize that there's a lot of things that I really don't know about my parents. I don't know about my family. And, you know, as I get older and as they get older, I'm just like, wow, I'm going to lose that.
Yeah, I went through the exercise a few years ago when my brother got married, I wanted to give him something that was unique, that, you know, I like to make unique gifts for weddings. Right. And so for him, what I did was I contacted his fiance's family and I got in touch with all of my relatives and I found all of the family recipes and asked everybody to give me a little like paragraph about each recipe and where it came from. And, you know, and then I put together a book that I gave to him. Lord knows if he uses it or not. I sure hope he does because it was made with a lot of love.
You know, it's good to have a record of those things.
Yeah, and that's what I think is if you go down and or even just email people and say, I'm looking to put together a collection of the history of our family through food. And you put it together and then send everybody a copy for a holiday or just send it to them in, like May, who knows? And just be like, I put this together and if you have any other stories, send them to me. And I think that people in general have this real desire for their stories to be told and for their stories to outlive them.
Yeah.
And I think that if you ask, I mean, I remember when my son was born, my mom came up and I said, hey, I really don't know very much about your childhood and about your mother and your father. And I would love that information. I would love that knowledge. And we sat down and she just told me, it was like 4 hours of family history. And I kick myself that I didn't record it in any way. Cause now I forget like all of it. Cause I had just had a baby.
Right.
So,
right.
Sleep
right there.
It was just like, I remember being like, just having like rapt attention. Like, this is amazing. All of this information is wonderful. All of this information about my grandmother and who she was and my grandfather and sort of like the dark side of them, which I had never heard about. All I ever knew was like they had a beautiful grape trellis in their backyard and they used to make me jam and we did puzzles together and that's like my understanding of them.
Right.
But my mom has this totally different history and these different memories and a lot of them are very food-based too. And I think that cataloging that is our job.
Yeah.
I think part of me wanted to create a podcast to capture those stories, but from lots and lots of different people.
Yeah. I think it's nice to have a sense of your place in the grand scheme of things. You know, I think it's easy as a human being to feel isolated from others, even from other people in your family. But again, there's something about those stories that really... You're a part of something. Mm-hmm. You're a part of history. Even if it's just kind of your local traditions, it's about where you come from, where you're going, where your children, if you choose to have them, might end up. Mm-hmm. And it's just that very, like, you have a place in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so pleased that Aaliyah could join me as my first guest. She has a kind and open nature that came through so well as we spoke. Before I wrap up, I'd like to tell you a little bit about something I made this week. A few days ago, my son turned 1, and we had a barbecue for family and friends to celebrate. I love making food for my family, especially my children. Watching them enjoy something that I've created for them gives me so much joy. So I used the opportunity to bake him a big chocolate cake. There were lots of children at the party, so I made sure that it was on the healthy side, getting much of its sweetness from bananas. He had a big piece all to himself, and made sure to get lots of it on his face and in his hair. He looked so pleased with himself by the end. That brings us to the end of our first episode. Thanks again to Aaliyah for being my first guest. Thank you to Chuck Salamone for composing our theme music, our system admin Greg Thole for hosting us, and Becky Carpenter for designing our logo and helping to record this first episode. Thank you to my husband Joe for encouraging me to take this journey. And most importantly, thank you for listening. Now, go make something for someone you love.